so long as Iraq is allowing the inspectors to go where they want to go, I think it's going to be hard for the United States to build a case against Iraq.
We ask every day, why is there billions of dollars to go to war and not money to give people health care and a basic essential things they need?
We are by no means through assessing this document. As I mentioned before, it's some 12,000 pages in total. So, I mean, we will have to reserve our judgment until our analysts have come up with a more detailed analysis.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, December 16th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The United States says it had problems with the documents Iraq gave to the United Nations on its weapons programs. Secretary of State Colin Powell is quoted in today's Washington Post saying, "We said at the very beginning that we approached it with skepticism, and the information I have received so far is that that skepticism is well-founded. There are problems with the declaration." Powell told a news conference with Japanese ministers and Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, "We are sharing the problems we see with UNMOVIC, the UN Inspectorate, and IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and we're in discussions with the permanent members of the Security Council." Iraq gave the United Nations 12,000 pages of documents earlier this month, and U.S. experts have been analyzing them to see how they match Washington's own information. Powell said the United States would not make a final judgment on the documents until late this week. But the top Republican on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence called the document a, quote, bogus report, insisting it lacks credibility. U.N. Weapons Inspector Hans Blix is scheduled to brief the Security Council on the report this Thursday, and Peace Watch spoke with his representative, Ewan Buchanan, about how the team is operating in Baghdad.
Well, clearly on the ground in Iraq, we now have a full team, which is more than 100 inspectors from both UNMOVIC and the IAEA, and clearly their job is to follow up and inspect sites to determine what activity may or may not be going on at those sites. I mean, clearly looking for signs of any remains of weapons programs, but also to be there to deter and detect any potential efforts by the Iraqis to rebuild their weapons programs. And those inspectors are going out on an almost daily basis, fanning out across the country, doing multiple inspections simultaneously. But secondly, in addition to what's going on the ground in Iraq, I mean, we have here a whole division of analysis and assessment who are now looking through the declaration which Iraq provided to us on the 8th of December. And this is a 12,000-page document, which is being analyzed by my colleagues.
Mm-hmm. And in that document, they say they have no weapons of mass destruction, yet the U.S. says that's balderdash or hogwash, and that they've dismissed the report as incomplete or bogus. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, we are obviously, I mean, here at the United Nations analyzing that document against the information that we already have from previous inspection work, from the work of the previous organization, from our files, from our database of old information or declarations by Iraq. But it's too early for us to be able to give a firm assessment. Dr. Blix, who's the head of UNMOVIC, and Dr. El Baradei, who's the head of the IAEA, which deals with the nuclear side of things, are going to be giving a preliminary assessment to the Security Council later this week. Mm-hmm. And that will be our first chance to tell the Security Council members our assessment of the declaration.
So if you could talk a little bit specifically about the kind of information that was contained in that report and what the UN is doing with it.
Well, the document has two major parts. One is to provide an account of the past weapons programs of Iraq, and secondly, to provide an account of their existing infrastructure in the chemical and biological areas, which are not weapons-related. And those are being studied by my colleagues now.
Mm-hmm. After Iraq's report was delivered to the UN's office in New York, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice arranged for the sole copy of the report to be taken to Washington so it could be copied and distributed to the other Security Council members. Was UNMOVIC concerned about the U.S. having undue influence and involvement in this delicate process?
Well, one thing I should point out, that it was not the sole copy. There was another copy which we at UNMOVIC and our nuclear colleagues in Vienna had shared between us, so it was not the only copy. But the shipping of the document to Washington was something which had been agreed by the president of the Security Council, and therefore, you know, we work for the Security Council, and if the Security Council president wishes to come up with that arrangement, that was something we followed through on.
But did it give you reason for concern or pause?
No, I don't believe so, no.
The U.S. announced over the weekend that it is rejecting the Iraqi arms report because the document is incomplete and leaves out key information about weapons and weapon systems that the U.S. claims that Iraq possesses. What's your response to that?
Well, we are by no means through assessing this document. As I mentioned before, it's some 12,000 pages in total. So, I mean, we will have to reserve our judgment until our analysts have come up with a more detailed analysis, and that will take some time here.
Now, the chief UN weapons inspector, Hans Blix, and the rest of his team have been criticized over the past several weeks in what some observers have called a concerted effort by the Bush administration to discredit and downplay the significance of the inspections process and the ability of the inspectors to successfully and adequately complete their work. From your view, how successful has the process been so far?
Well, I think we're off to a reasonably good start. The Security Council members had given us, in fact, until the 23rd of December to start inspections, whereas we had our first teams on the ground and working on the 27th of November. And we're now up to a kind of strength of more than 100 inspectors who are actively able to fan out across the country and do inspections. So I think we're off to a fairly good start physically on the ground. And so far, there have not been any major impediments in our work on the ground.
Many people are waiting for the smoking gun, so to speak. Any chances that you'll actually come across data or material that would qualify as such?
Well, clearly, we are inspecting to look for any remnants of the programs, but it's too early to say what we will find. I mean, we would hope that Iraq would declare any weapons that it may still possess.
There's so much concern as to whether or not Saddam Hussein may have hidden things so deeply in tunnels and palaces and areas where it would be difficult for the inspectors to access. Do you think that that country has been completely cooperative in terms of allowing access to those places?
Well, so far, Iraq has not impeded any of the inspection teams on the ground, but it's too early to tell yet whether or not their declaration is indeed a full and complete account of their past weapons programs. But clearly, were Iraq to hide stuff from us, that would be in violation of the Council's resolutions. They are supposed to declare any weapons and not hide them.
Mm-hmm. Is the U.S. providing information to the UNMOVIC team at this time?
Well, clearly, inspections in a country as large as Iraq do have to be based on information, and information that is timely. And clearly, we would hope that any member state of the UN which possesses such information would provide it to us so that we can actually act on the Council's behalf and try and clean up the remaining questions over Iraq's weapons programs.
But has the U.S. been actually providing information to the team of inspectors?
Well, we have channels and systems set up here so that information from governments is handled on a need-to-know basis. And so therefore, that is to encourage providers to give us information on the grounds that such information would be held securely and not disseminated. So I am unable to tell you what information we may or may not be getting from member states of the UN.
Mm-hmm. There was some concern that there may be a scientist in Baghdad or throughout Iraq that might be of help to the UNMOVIC team. Have any such interviews taken place so far, or do you anticipate any?
Well, formal interviews of the type I think you're alluding to have not yet taken place, but clearly as the inspectors go about their business throughout Iraq, they are asking questions, interviewing site managers, asking people about their facilities, what work goes on there, who is involved, what are the main production processes, etc. So on-the-job interviews are proceeding apace.
What about the interviews where individuals may feel required to leave the country?
Well, we are exploring, all the options and the authority the Security Council has given us, but none of those sort of interviews has yet taken place.
Is there a need for those, do you think?
Well, it might be, perhaps, if Iraqis felt more comfortable about being debriefed or being interviewed outside of the country. If that were to be the case, then perhaps we could avail ourselves of that authority in the resolution.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, finally, how the inspectors are received by the people at the sites when they come in to do their work?
So far, the relationship has been, professional and reasonably good. We haven't had any incidents on the ground, and we would hope that would continue this way for the foreseeable future.
Ewan Buchanick is the public information officer for UNMOVIC. John Quigley, professor of international law at Ohio State University, says the U.S. has a tough case to make in convincing the world that Saddam Hussein is not cooperating with the inspectors.
I think the United States will be in a difficult position in part because of the fact that Iraq seems to have been complying generally with the wishes of the inspectors on the ground to have access to different sites. So there was a bit of a glitch in the last couple of days in one site inspection, but with that exception, it has more or less allowed access. And given that, I think the United States is going to have a difficult time convincing other countries that Iraq is out of compliance. Now, that, of course, is an issue a bit separate from that of the report itself. But what I'm saying is that I think even if there is skepticism about the completeness of the report itself, so long as Iraq is allowing the inspectors to go where they want to go, I think it's going to be hard for the United States to build a case against Iraq.
Now, you said it'll be difficult for them to build this case against Iraq to other countries. What about to this country, to Americans in this country who may not be accepting the administration's line?
Well, I think it will similarly make it difficult for the administration to convince skeptical Americans about its case. I mean, if Iraq is letting these inspectors go wherever they want to go, it's certainly open to the United States to give information to the inspectors about where they should go if the United States has information.
Is it time for them to put up or shut up, basically?
I think it may need to give more information than it has already given to the inspectors. It apparently is reluctant to give them some of the information it has. If that's the case, I think it's hurting its own cause.
I think many people are saying if the Bush administration, has a smoking gun, so to speak, now would be the time to provide it.
Well, I think it would be the time to provide it. Clearly, it's making a point against Iraq and making a charge, and it really isn't saying anything very solid to back it up.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix is due to brief the Security Council on Thursday of this week about his team's progress and its findings thus far. Do you think it's up to the United States to judge whether Iraq presents a threat, or is that determination better left to the weapons inspectors?
Well, it's certainly something that under the Security Council Resolution 1441 is to be decided by the weapons inspectors initially. That is, they're to report on it, but then the Security Council is to decide whether there has been material breach by Iraq. So the role of the weapons inspectors is to collect information and to present it to the Security Council. And the Security Council is supposed to decide. Now, the Security Council doesn't have much in the way of information apart from what it gets from the inspectors. So what the inspectors say will be very significant. Certainly here it's important to point out that the resolution 1441 leaves it to the Security Council to make this decision rather than to the United States. That is, it's not up to the United States to decide that there hasn't been compliance by Iraq. Now, that's been a point in contention. I think the United States may take the view that it is up to the United States to make that decision unilaterally, but that's clearly not what the resolution said, and it's not the way the resolution has been construed by other members of the Security Council.
Do you think this U.S. interpretation of what has happened so far with regard to whether Iraq has been forthcoming in its information about its weapons arsenal, is there something that we should be reading between the lines in terms of the administration's intentions or policies with regard to Iraq?
I think there is justifiable skepticism about the administration's motives in this because it does seem so dead set on proving Iraq to be wrong and very ready to criticize Iraq's report. I think that there is much sentiment in this country as well as abroad that the motivations of the administration really don't concern Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, but have more to do with the oil production in Iraq and the possibility of getting more contracts for U.S. corporations and dealing with that exploration. And I think to the extent that the administration is not forthcoming on the matters we've just been talking about, I think that skepticism is going to be reinforced.
In fact, Mohammed El Baradei, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, estimates that it could take inspectors as long as a year to give Iraq a clean bill of health for its nuclear capability alone. In your view, is it worth the wait, or, as the administration claims, does Iraq present such a threat that waiting that long could be dangerous?
Well, according to the report that the CIA put out a couple of months ago, Iraq is not a significant threat to the United States. And I don't think that contrary information has really come out that to suggest that Iraq is imminently going to cause any difficulty for the United States. I mean, even President Bush said that were Iraq to gain access to fissionable material, it would still take it a year to produce a nuclear weapon. So certainly with respect to nuclear weapons, there doesn't seem to be any immediate threat that Iraq might pose, even if you assume that it could deliver those weapons successfully and that it would do so, even knowing the kind of retaliation that would bring on it. So I suppose if you're talking about immediate threat, one has to talk about chemical or biological weapons other than nuclear weapons. But on that, I think the information isn't particularly clear as to what Iraq may possess.
Mm-hmm. Well, with respect to nuclear weapons, just as a matter of review, we know that North Korea has said that it actually has nuclear weapons, and I believe Pakistan has also said it has nuclear weapons or the capability. What other nations throughout the world have that capability, and why should we not be focusing our attentions on them as possible threats?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, there are others that have nuclear weapons. Certainly, Russia still has some. Israel has some. I think the administration's case has been grounded on two things. One, the possession or potential possession of such weapons by Iraq, and a proclivity on the part of Iraq to use weapons of mass destruction. So I think that second prong is the essential part of the administration's case. I think it's been undercut very substantially by the report the CIA put out.
And how many countries have actually used nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons against people throughout history?
Well, nuclear weapons, I guess the United States has used, has been the only one to have used during the Second World War. It was widely considered, I think, during the Cold War, in particular by the Eisenhower administration, but was never done. You had some use of gas during the First World War. There have been some
by whom?
By Germany. Mm-hmm. During the First World War. So you've had some, but there have been significant international efforts to stop the use of those weapons, with treaties then in the 1920s against them. And I think there are very significant reasons why states would be reluctant to use such things, in part because of their ineffectiveness. And for a state like Israel, it has nuclear weapons, but in the region where it would be likely to use them, the fallout would harm the whole region, including Israel itself, potentially. So there are considerations of that kind.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's interesting, and we can't gloss over the fact that the U.S. is the only country in the world to date that has ever used a nuclear weapon against people.
Yes, that's right. You know, we forget that often, that we did do that against Japan. We did it at a time when Japan was really on its knees and probably would have had to concede the war within a short time anyway. It probably wasn't a necessary thing to do, and the harm we caused was very substantial.
John Quigley is professor of international law at Ohio State University. Over 100 celebrities and former military officials signed on to a full-page ad in the New York Times last week, urging the Bush administration to win without war in Iraq. Their newly formed group entitled Artists United to Win Without War includes actors Matt Damon and Samuel L. Jackson, actress Helen Hunt, musician Dave Matthews, and former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Edward Peck. Also among the ranks of those voicing concern towards the impending war is actor Sean Penn. In October, he paid $56,000 for an advertisement in the Washington Post accusing President Bush of stifling debate on Iraq. More recently, Penn concluded a three-day visit to Iraq on Sunday as a guest of the public policy group, the Institute for Public Accuracy. Speaking at a press conference in Baghdad over the weekend, Sean Penn said that he was obliged to take the trip to find his own voice on matters of conscience.
I needed to come here and see a smile, see a street, smell the smells, talk to the people, and take that home with me. I didn't come here to criticize any government or any president, but I will say this. I find it personally baffling that at a time like this, I cannot conceive of any reason why the American people and the world would not have shared with them the evidence that they claim to have of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I think that the more information we push for, the more information we're given, the better off we're all going to be and the right thing will happen.
Actor Sean Penn speaking to reporters in Iraq. The reaction in the mainstream media to some of the anti-war sentiments coming from Hollywood has often been one of scorn and ridicule, questioning both the motives and intelligence of anyone who raises his or her voice to protest. This has troubled Peace Watch commentator Paul Loeb, who's been wondering just who is qualified to voice dissent nowadays.
I was thinking when I heard the recent group of actors and prominent individuals speaking out against going to war with Iraq, how quickly and cavalierly the media dismissed them. And it struck me that this is a reflex action that applies to really almost everybody in our society who speaks out to challenge institutions of power. So we dismiss, or the powers that be will dismiss, a Sean Penn or a Martin Sheen and say, well, you know, what do they really know about war and peace? And who are they? And they're just sort of pampered limousine liberals, and they'll resurrect all those kinds of stereotypes to avoid our coming to grips with the actual issues that they're raising as citizens by trying to take on some of the larger questions that we're facing, like whether or not to go to war with Iraq. But it isn't just the celebrities that get dismissed. In a way, all of us will get dismissed in different ways. If we're young, they'll say, well, obviously we don't know enough. They're just students. That's what students do. So we don't have to take them seriously. If they're people like myself from the Vietnam generation, they'll say, well, they're just nostalgic for Vietnam and the anti-war days. They're just trying to refight their old battles. If they're professors or academic eggheads, the religious leaders are naive. And you can have a situation where, if you think about what we have right now, the recent Win Without War Coalition, we've got the NAACP, we've got National Council of Churches, we've got the Sierra Club, we've got groups like Working Assets and MoveOn.org, quite broad spectrum of ordinary citizens. In some way, having a voice that says, at the very least, let's put the brakes on this rush to war, and yet for every group, for every individual, there's a way in which the culture will dismiss it and essentially say, you really aren't the right person to speak out, you really don't know enough, you really don't have the standing. And if you strip it down, what you end up with is, well, who has standing? Henry Kissinger has standing, Donald Rumsfeld has standing. And what it does is it essentially is a way of ignoring the voices and the real issues raised by ordinary citizens. One of the things that I've written about over the years is a mechanism by which a lot of us, unfortunately, end up internalizing that response, where we say to ourselves after a while of hearing this, oh, I guess I don't really know enough. I guess I don't have every single piece of possible classified data. I mean, nobody does. And we end up deciding that whatever that issue is, certainly applies to foreign policy, but applies to environmental issues, applies to domestic issues of social justice, that whatever it is, we really don't quite know enough, or we're not in the quite perfect position to be able to act and take a stand, or we're not the sort of most morally evolved human being on the planet, a sort of perfect saint, and therefore we can't act. And I think what occurs then is that this ends up taking a whole lot of ordinary citizens out of politics, out of being able to take common responsibility for the most critical issues of our time. Because if you're not the right person to speak out, and if you don't have the standing, then all that's really left is silence and passive acquiescence. The alternative to dismissing everyone to act is to say, all right, we're a human being on this planet, and the very process of a human being caring and trying to take a stand on a difficult issue should be admired and respected. If we were in Milosevic's Yugoslavia or Czechoslovakia before 89, we wouldn't say, well, gosh, we don't know everything, we don't have every fact, they have all the information that we don't. We would say, or at least we hope we would, we want to act with courage and vision. We want to speak out for the world, as just a world as possible and for democracy. And we're going to do that as best we can. And I think that if enough citizens act, in fact, and speak out, and not just the ones who are well-known, that's when a society begins to change. And that's what we have to do.
Commentator Paul Loeb is the author of Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in a Cynical Time. The cost of an attack on Iraq is a growing concern for many. In Washington, D.C., seniors, their children, and anti-war activists rallied last week at City Hall. They demanded the restoration of prescription drug benefits cut this year by the city to save money. Tom Gomez from WBIX.org in Washington brings us some of their voices.
We really see the connections between the lack of health care, taking prescription drugs away from seniors, not having decent housing for the poor, not having decent schools for our kids, intimately part of this whole war machine. And we ask every day, why is there billions of dollars to go to war and not money to give people health care and the basic essential things they need?
Health care, not warfare.
My name is Georgia Akin. Right now I feel weak because I ain't took my regular dose. I try to stretch my medicine. And some people are losing their lives. You don't hear much about it, but people are dying.
These are people that don't have money. My name is Olivia Williams. This is my mother, Georgia Atkins. Also, they're actually promoting war. And it takes billions and billions of dollars for war. I look at TV every night. That's what they're doing, promoting war.
We want the public to understand this issue, to reopen our public hospital, and to restore prescription coverage for our low-income seniors.
No peace. The money that we're spending to advance war upon another nation is money that's taken away from the everyday citizens and out of the pockets of taxpaying citizens in this country, to the great detriment of this country, and we have to stop it.
Right. We might have to have a sit-in out here, we might have to sleep out here, but we have to do whatever it is to win back health care for the people, and I mean everybody.
Take care of our seniors!
Take care of our seniors! Take care of our seniors!
Thanks to Tom Gomez and Reem Kathuda of WBIX.org for that report. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, we'll go to New York for a youth rally and to Turkey for some analysis.